tomorrow. Thanks for coming along again this evening, and if there's anybody here for the first time, hello for the first time. First of all, have you all got a copy of the first night's summary that we've been distributing out? Good. Okay. Right, well, just I'll get cracking then. I suppose, first of all, what I'd like to do this evening is just a quick review of the first night. And as you'll remember from the first night, what we said was that the evidence suggests that the Gospels we read today are pretty accurate versions of the original Gospel texts. And the Gospels were written shortly after Jesus' death, and as a result, there's a good chance they're accurate descriptions of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And we talked about the ins and outs of that. I mean, these are all balance of probabilities, I guess, but the evidence, it points in that direction, essentially. So tonight, what we're going to do is have a look at some of the historical and archaeological evidence for Jesus. And it's sometimes suggested that although Jesus saw himself as a teacher and Jewish holy man, he didn't regard himself as the Son of God. Indeed, some have claimed that as a good Jew, Jesus would have regarded such a view of himself as blasphemous. However, a detailed study of the Gospel suggests that this isn't the case. Now, I guess Jesus' view of himself as the Son of God is probably most explicit in the Gospel that was written last, that is the Gospel of John. And you might remember from the first evening, I mentioned that the Gospel of John was written around about 90 AD. And if you read John, you'll find that its style and the words of Jesus are quite different from the other three Gospels. Christian theology is also, I guess, more developed in John compared to the other three Gospels. And this has prompted some historians and biblical scholars to be more sceptical of the details of John. The view is that as John was written once Christianity was more developed, this may have had an influence on the Gospel's content. Now, personally, I've actually got some sympathy with this view. It's not to say the Gospel of John's worthless or anything like that. It's just that you might have to look carefully through some of the theology to see a clearer picture of Jesus. So, to address this issue, we'll limit our search for evidence for Jesus' view of himself to Mark's Gospel. What's happened here? There's a bit missing. Strangely enough. Okay. I see what's happened here. Right, I'm just going to have to read this with my notes, unfortunately. No, there's nothing. There's a slide has disappeared from the presentation. So, we'll limit our search for evidence of Jesus' view of himself to Mark's Gospel, as I said. Now, you'll remember from part one that Mark was the Gospel that was written first, around 30 to 40 years after Jesus' death. Gospel tradition states that Mark was John Mark, a companion of Peter, one of Jesus' disciples. Now, in Mark, Jesus never seems to come out and directly say, "I am the Son of God." Well, if that's the case, what clues does he give as to his view of himself in Mark? Well, I guess the first clue he does is he provides in Mark's Gospel is that he forgives sins. In the miracle narratives, Jesus sometimes links the physical or mental affliction of the person about to be healed with that person's sinfulness. For example, in Mark chapter 2, he says, "Son, your sins are forgiven," as a precursor for the healing of the paralytic. Now, is any good Jew knew? I'm just going to quickly check this. Hang on. Keep going down. I've got this. No, it's not there. My apologies. I was doing some revision on this a couple of weeks ago, and it looks like I've managed to successfully get rid of part of the presentation. Anyway, back to what I was saying about Mark forgiving sins. As I say, he sometimes links the healing of a person with his sinfulness. And as I say, in Mark chapter 2, he says, "Son, your sins are forgiven," as a precursor to the healing of a paralytic. Now, as any good Jew knew, Only God can forgive sins. Jesus knew the Jewish scriptures and teachings. In acting in this way, he was directly linking himself with God. In Mark, he says that the Jewish religious authorities also realized this and accused him of blasphemy as a result. Also, Jesus teaches on his own authority. Now, this might appear as a bit of a technicality, but in Judaism, you required two people to conduct religious teaching, one to witness what the other was teaching, and vice versa. Jesus, however, makes a point of teaching alone. He precedes many of his teachings with the words, "I tell you the truth." So what, you might say? Well, any other Jewish teacher in the first century would say something like, "I tell you the truth, and here's another teacher standing next to me to verify that I'm telling the truth." So why is that important? Well, a Jewish audience would know that only God can teach on his own authority. Again, Jesus was linking himself directly with God by teaching in this particular way. A third clue in Mark's gospel would be that he refers to God as Father or Abba, Aramaic for dad or daddy. Well, so what again, you might say? Isn't God regularly referred to as Father in the Christian church? It doesn't mean that Christians believe that God is their actual father. I guess the problem here is that we're used to the Christian view of having an intimate father-child relationship with God, a relationship modeled in Jesus' relationship with God. As a result, it's been common in the last 2,000 years to refer to God as Father. However, to first century Jews, calling God Father would be blasphemous. Jews weren't even allowed to mention God's name, the tetragram YHWH, often pronounced Jehovah. So to refer to God as dad or daddy would be seen by Jews as downright eccentric, as well as blasphemous, unless, of course, you actually were God's son. And his miracles had symbolic meaning to those that were performed in front of you, in front of. One of the miracles that I'm going to talk to, unfortunately, I don't have any photographs for this, because I seem to have managed to have lost them in my presentation, is the calming of the storm. Suggested to those that witnessed it that Jesus was God. And in that event, in Mark's gospel, Jesus and his disciples are on an open boat in the Sea of Galilee when they're caught in a violent storm. As the wind and waves rage, the boat begins to fill with water. Jesus is sleeping at the back of a boat in a cushion. Disciples wake him up shouting, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" I see what I've done here. My apologies. That's terrible. I'm way, way ahead of my presentation. What have I done here? What have I done here? That's what I've done. Can I start again, please? Right. Ignore the last 5 minutes. Oh, dear. Right, I can see exactly what I've done, and goodness knows how I managed to do it. So, right, let's start again. Okay. That's where we got to. Right. Okay, so let's start off with the historical evidence. Is there good historical evidence for Jesus outside the Bible? Well, I should start by saying that there's no reliable written document describing the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that's contemporary with the Gospels and Paul's letters. Now, that sometimes presents difficulties for both Christians and non-Christians today. If the events of Jesus' life were so momentous, why were they not written about by other writers at the time? Well, if I'm honest, we don't ultimately know the answer to this question. However, the likely answer is rather mundane if we stop to consider who might have recorded this. The people that were capable of writing about the events of Jesus' life were the Romans, Greek administrators, and Jewish scribes. From a Roman and Greek perspective, Jesus would have been seen as just another Jewish holy man who had stirred up the Jews in Jerusalem and was quickly dealt with before he could cause any real trouble. These events were occurring in a tiny part of the Roman Empire, where this kind of thing happened regularly. Palestine then was as volatile as it is now, and would really have hardly been worthy of a mention. And there's a picture of the Roman Empire at its height, about AD 116 AD. And as you can see, Palestine, or what was even called Palestine, Judea and Galilee, down the bottom right-hand corner, The Romans had considerably more to deal with at that time. Things like the Dacians were revolting. The German tribes just north of the Roman Empire, what they were doing in Britannia at the time. These were all major issues, the lives of the emperors. What was going on in the bottom right-hand corner of the Roman Empire really was small beer in comparison to that. The other people that could have been writing about Jesus at that time, I guess, were the Jewish scribes working in the temple hierarchy. Now, their view of him, too, was that it was just another in a long line of troublemakers with delusions that he was the Messiah. And as with the Romans, it really would have been hardly worth a mention. However, if the Jewish scribes had written about Jesus, it would have had to survive the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 70 and then again in AD 135. I won't go into the detail of the Jewish uprisings at these times or the Roman response, other than to say that the Romans ultimately flattened the city, destroyed the Jewish temple completely, and either killed or scattered the Jewish inhabitants. Not ideal conditions for the survival of documents, particularly in Jewish eyes, the less important non-sacred documents. The picture we're looking at here is the Arch of Titus in Rome, and you can see the Romans are bringing back the spoils of the sack of Jerusalem. Back to Rome. So, is that it? Well, actually, no. Although there are no reliable documents describing Jesus' life, there are a number of documents describing Jesus' early followers. And here are a few examples. Josephus, in AD 93, wrote a book called The Antiquities. Joseph was a Jewish historian, and he describes in this book the arresting and execution of a Christian, James, the brother of Jesus. And Tacitus was a Roman historian in his History of Rome, which he wrote in AD 115. He describes how Nero persecuted Christians as scapegoats to divert suspicion away from himself for the great fire of Rome in AD 64. And Pliny the Younger, in 111 AD, in one of his books, he describes his own persecution of Christians when he was governor of Bithynia in what is now northwest Turkey. So what do these admittedly brief mentions of Christians tell us? Well, one thing it tells us is that there were a sufficient number of people who saw themselves as Christians in Rome in 64 AD to be singled out for attention by Nero. Now, to be a persecuted minority, there have to be sufficient numbers of that minority to come to the attention of the majority. To use a contemporary example, consider asylum seekers in the UK today. Now, there have been people seeking asylum in the UK for hundreds of years. However, they've only begun to be seen as a group called asylum seekers when their numbers grew significantly in the last few years. So, the reference in Tacitus tells us that less than 35 years after Jesus' death, there was a Christian community large enough and vocal enough to be noticed by the emperor and worthy of persecution in Rome. The Pliny reference also tells us that there was also a Christian community worthy of persecution, again inverted commas, and of note in northwest Turkey towards the end of the first century AD. Now, we set a lot of store by archaeology today, and I guess this is because archaeology gives us a direct link to history by producing objects from the past which we can see and touch. However, does archaeology provide any evidence for Jesus being the Son of God? Does archaeology provide supporting evidence to the places and events described in the Gospels and letters of Paul? This picture here shows the reconstruction of a nail embedded in the foot bone of a crucifixion victim. The smaller item to the right of it is the actual foot bone and nail found in Jerusalem. This has been dated to the first century. Significantly, this bone was found in a Jewish tomb. What this told archaeologists and historians was that the Romans permitted Jewish crucifixion victims to be buried in accordance with Jewish customs and tradition. Prior to this find, historians were undecided about the fate of those Jews crucified by the Romans. Many thought that Jewish corpses were just thrown in the municipal rubbish dump, as was the fate of non-Jewish crucifixion victims. This is significant to the death of Jesus. It makes it more likely that he was buried in a tomb, as it says in the Gospels. The next picture shows the results of an archaeological dig in Nazareth. Although this says nothing about the life of Jesus, it has demonstrated that there was a village on the site of present-day Nazareth in the first century, as it says in the Gospels. The next picture shows a replica of a Dead Sea Scroll. As you probably know, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947 and are written texts produced by the Essenes, a Jewish sect that existed in the first century Judea. These scrolls contain parts of the Old Testament and also contain texts specifically relating to the life, beliefs, and hopes of the Essenes. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls have no mention of Jesus. However, they do help us to understand the history of first century Palestine and the mindset of Jews living at that time. This, in turn, helps us to understand certain aspects of the Gospels, particularly relating to Jewish messianic expectations. However, we have to be careful with archaeological finds. Burial practices in first century Palestine often involved the body being placed in a rock tomb and left there to allow the flesh to decay. Sometime later, the tomb would be opened and the bones that were left would be placed in a box called an ossuary. Often this ossuary contained bones of several members of the same family, thus reuniting family members in death. Now, the ossuary you see here came to light a few years ago. On the side of the ossuary is an inscription in Aramaic, the language of first century Galilee and Judea, that reads, "James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus." And this find caused a major stir in the archaeological world and was heralded as the most significant find since the Dead Sea Scrolls. Unfortunately, subsequent investigation has revealed this find to be an elaborate hoax. As there's so much interest in this particular time period, historical interest in this particular time period, there's a market for artifacts from this time. And as any capitalist will tell you, if there's a market, there'll be marketeers, honest or otherwise, to satisfy the demands of the market. So, care needs to be taken in assuming that every archaeological find is genuine. Care also needs to be taken not to overstate the importance of archaeology in providing evidence for Jesus. I think it's fair to say to date, archaeology has not provided definitive proof that Jesus is or isn't the Son of God. However, what I think I can say is that archaeology has not to date provided information that is directly contradictory to the Gospels. In general, the consensus view is that archaeology provides a generally supportive picture of the places and events described in the Gospels. So this is where I shouldn't have started. So before we move on, it's probably worthwhile reviewing what we said. I said that we saw that there was good evidence to say that the Gospels and letters of Paul were written shortly after Jesus' death. As a result of this, it's unlikely that these documents would have been subject to much embellishment due to legends and myths developing around Jesus. We can therefore be confident the Gospels on the whole provide a fairly accurate view of the events of Jesus' life and death. The evidence from inside and outside the Bible and from Paul's letters suggests that Christian belief developed very shortly after Jesus' death and that it spread very quickly for a time that had no mass communications through the Roman Empire. And we also saw that the Gospels and letters of Paul that we read today are most likely to be accurate versions of what was written nearly 2,000 years ago. Finally, we briefly mentioned that archaeology provides a generally supportive picture of the places and events mentioned in the Gospels. So, this concludes our brief review of the sources we draw upon for information on Jesus. And I hope you agree that there's good evidence to allow these sources to be used as a basis for further study on who Jesus is. So, what do these documents tell us about Jesus? So, was Jesus convinced he was the Son of God? So, as I said earlier on, I won't go back over this again. What we do here is we look at Mark's Gospel, the Gospel that was written earliest, rather than John's Gospel, the Gospel that was written last, which I guess has the most explicit view of Jesus being the Son of God. And as I said, in Mark's Gospel, number of clues to suggest that Jesus forgives, that Jesus is the Son of God, about forgiving sins, teaching on his own authority, as I mentioned previously, refers to God as Father, blasphemous statement for Jews, and the miracles had symbolic importance to those they were performed in front of. And I mentioned about the calming of the storms, the miracle. Now, this was something that was brought to the fore in the recent BBC TV series, The Miracles of Jesus. Don't know if you saw the programme, and if you have, I'm maybe going over old ground here. However, what was clear is that the miracles that Jesus performed, and this was discussed in some detail in this particular programme, was that the miraculous events often had similarities to events that are described in the Old Testament. And so Jesus could be seen as linking himself to such Jewish figures as Moses, Elijah, and Joshua. The view is that by performing these miracles, or signs as they're often called in the Gospels, in these particular ways, the Jewish audience who witnessed the miracles would connect Jesus with these Jewish prophets and heroes. But the miracles also suggested to their audience that Jesus is God. And we was going on to talk about the calming of the storm as an example of that. In this event, Jesus and his disciples are in an open boat on the Sea of Galilee when they're caught in a violent storm. As the wind and waves rage and the boat begins to fill with water, Jesus is sleeping at the back of the boat on a cushion. The disciples wake him up shouting, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" Jesus gets up and shouts at the wave, "Quiet, be still." And at this, the storm immediately abates. Jesus then gives his disciples a hard time for their lack of faith in him. Now, at this time, Jews believed that only God had control of the elements. Further, Jews believed that Satan's home was under the waves and waters of the seas and lakes. For Jesus to take control of the wind and waves in this way was a clear sign to his followers that he was God and that he had control over Satan. No wonder the disciples were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and waves obey him." So, in summary, I think it's fair to say that these points do not provide conclusive proof that Jesus is the Son of God. However, it certainly indicates that it was very likely that he thought of himself in this particular way. Well, it's all very well thinking you're the Son of God. There are many people alive today in mental institutions and being cared for in the community that might think something similar. So, was Jesus also severely deluded to think of himself in this particular way? Well, there's an interesting chapter in the book, The Case for Christ, the book I mentioned last week, where Lee Strobel, the author of the book, interviews a psychologist who specializes in treating delusional people. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the psychologist says that from the Gospels, there are no hints or indications that Jesus is exhibiting some of the behavior associated with people who have mental problems. Perhaps the best way of addressing this, as I've suggested in the first evening, is to read the Gospels for yourself. When I did this for the first time a few years ago, I was surprised to find some illuminating and awkward glimpses of Jesus' human personality. I guess I was expecting to find a serene, focused, consistent, godlike person. True enough, that was there. But what I didn't expect to find was clear evidence of Jesus' humanness. For example, I mentioned in the first evening his anger at a fig tree. He seems to be continually frustrated at his disciples and their dullness and lack of faith. He weeps at the death of his friend Lazarus, even though he then brings him back to life. And he's clearly frightened the night before his execution, but he knows what's going to happen. He knows what's going to be happening out the other end of the crucifixion. So it seems odd he's so particularly frightened. What I found, I guess, was a clear picture of Jesus as a human being and of being God at the same time. And exhibiting behavior one might expect from both, all mixed together in a rather complex way. I guess what I saw in the Gospels was one of the central themes of Christianity, that God became man. What I didn't find, though, was any erratic, unstable, delusional behavior. Now, look, I'm no psychologist, but the human Jesus seemed to me as normal as the rest of us. So,
It looks from the Gospels that Jesus saw himself as the Son of God and the Messiah. And there are no clues in the Gospel to suggest he was massively deluded. However, what if he unintentionally misled his disciples so that they believed he was the Son of God? What if he sincerely believed he was the Son of God, but was just wrong? What if the whole thing just got out of hand? In the whole messianic and revolutionary fervor of first century Palestine, with Jesus caught in the middle. Alternatively, what if he deliberately misled his disciples? What if he had some other agenda for saying he was the Son of God? What if all the miracles and healings were actually sleight of hand, deceptions, and magic tricks? I think these are all reasonable questions to ask and reasonable things to explore. So what I'll do is I'll step through each of these points individually in the coming slides. So let's start with, well, did Jesus unintentionally mislead his followers so that they believed he was the Son of God? Now, earlier we talked about a little bit about whether Jesus was severely deluded, mad, if you prefer, to think that he was the Son of God. And my guess is that we're all quite comfortable with concluding that it's unlikely that Jesus had serious mental health problems. But what if he unintentionally misled his followers? What if he sincerely believed he was the Son of God, but was just wrong? Now, this is a common argument put forward by non-Christians. To quote Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion, page 92 of the hardback version, if you want to look it up, a fourth possibility, almost too obvious to need mentioning, is that Jesus was honestly mistaken that he was the Son of God. Plenty of people are. Well, indeed, plenty of people are honestly mistaken about all kinds of things. It doesn't make them mad. I've been honestly mistaken about all kinds of things in my life. However, if I stood up here right now, looked at you all in a kind of focused way, and said with all sincerity, people, I'm the Son of God. No, really, I'm not kidding. I'm the Son of God. Now, I know it sounds unlikely, but believe me, I am the Son of God. Well, what would you think? I think the politest thing you would probably say is that Derek needs a wee bit of a sit down and have a drink of water to clear his head. So what am I saying? What I'm saying is you can't have it both ways. If you think you're God, then you're either wrong in the head or you are God. Further, if you think you're God and are prepared to do something about it by going on a mission that collects followers, challenges the established religious order and ends up getting you killed, then you really are wrong in the head. Or God. But what about the other explanation I mentioned? What if the whole thing just kind of got out of hand in the whole messianic and revolutionary fervor in first century Judea with Jesus caught in the middle? I suppose you could call this the Life of Brian effect. I'm sure some of you have seen Monty Python's Life of Brian. In it, Brian, the illegitimate child of a Roman centurion and Terry Jones, is mistaken by a group of Jewish zealots for the Messiah. Despite his best efforts, everything that he says or does make his growing band of followers believe more strongly that he is the Messiah. If you haven't seen the film, it's a cracking satire on the type of narrow-mindedness, bigotry, and dogmatism that can give organized religion a bad name. There's also some touching references in the film to the real Jesus, who's conducting his mission at the same time as Brian, but is always just off screen. So, was Jesus just caught up in events like Brian? As I keep suggesting, if you read the Gospels for yourself, you'll see that Jesus was clearly directing the events of his mission. Jesus didn't need to perform his miracles. Jesus didn't need to spend days teaching his followers, changing their lives in the process. Jesus didn't need to create the disturbance in the temple area. Jesus could have apologized, melted away into the crowd, and avoided death by crucifixion, but didn't. It's clear that Jesus knew exactly what he was doing from the moment he returned from the desert, 40 days after his baptism by John the Baptist. So, it's pretty unlikely he unintentionally misled his followers. Or could he have deliberately misled his followers so that they believed he was the Son of God? What if all the miracles were just elaborate hoaxes, hypnotism, magic tricks, sleight of hand? It's possible. You might remember a program that was on a few Christmases ago called The Magic of Jesus, where the two magicians on the left-hand side recreated some of Jesus' miracles. And in his regular TV appearances, hypnotist, illusionist, and ex-evangelical Christian Derren Brown seems to be able to make people believe all kinds of things. So, could the miracles have just been magic tricks and illusions perpetrated on simple first-century Galilean country folk? However, for such a proposition to be a likely explanation, you have to ask the following question. Why would he do it? As we've shown, Jesus' actions were designed by his followers to see him as God. We've also shown he didn't seem to be exhibiting any delusional behavior. We've just shown that it's very unlikely that he unintentionally misled his followers. So, by rational deduction, if Jesus is not God, then all we're left with is the possibility that he deliberately misled his followers. So if he did this, what would Jesus' motive be for deceiving his followers? Well, in the past and present, there have been other charismatic leaders who have used deception to gain a political or religious following. What kind of motives did they have for doing such a thing? The motives I can think of for behaving in this way, off the top of my head, are, well, ends justify the means, possibly. There have been many people who have been convinced that their political or religious views would make the lives of their followers better. If achieving these ends meant that a bit of deception, double dealing and ruthlessness was required on these followers, then so be it. Better that some loyal followers suffer so that the majority gain the benefits. Control over other people is, for some people, an end in itself. They seem to hunger for the devotion of others. They seem to get some form of kick out of manipulating and controlling people. People like this will do anything to have a following. Simple deception is often the least of their crimes. For some people, fame is an end in itself. It's really important for them to come to the attention of others. For some people, it doesn't matter if they're admired or reviled, just so long as they're famous. For people like this, a bit of deception would be a very small price to pay for fame. Attention seeking. I had friends who knew a woman who pretended to have cancer so she could get all kinds of attention from her friends, family, and work colleagues. She managed to keep this deception up for more than a year. Clearly for this woman, and many other people, a bit of deception to get some attention is seen as necessary. And what about good old-fashioned material gain? Some people have just been motivated to do terrible things for simple material gain, to make their lives comfortable. If others have to suffer to achieve this, then it's regrettable, but just too bad. So the question really is do we see evidence of any of these motives in Jesus' mission? Well, perhaps one way of answering this is to look at other charismatic figures from the past and present who have gathered together a band of followers and challenged the current political, religious, or power structures of the day. Do we see any echoes of their behavior in Jesus' mission? I'm going to put this together off the top of my head. Here were a few of charismatic leaders I could think of at the time. In the political arena, you've got Lenin, leader of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, Fidel Castro, leader of the Communist Revolution in Cuba, Mahatma Gandhi, leader of the independence movement in India, Adolf Hitler, leader of the National Socialists in Germany, Nelson Mandela, first president of post-apartheid South Africa, Mao Zedong, and good old Pol Pot, all charismatic leaders for their followers in the political arena. Messianic religious cult leaders I could think of. Well, David Koresh is the picture up there, the charismatic leader of the Branch Davidian cult. You may remember David Koresh and his followers all died in the siege at Waco, Texas back in 1993. Jim Jones, charismatic founder of the People's Temple cult. Jones and his followers set up their community in Jonestown in Guyana. They committed mass suicide in 1978. And Charles Manson, charismatic leader of the family, currently serving life for the horrendous murders that he and his followers committed back in the 60s. Other religious leaders, Martin Luther, challenged the accepted Christian orthodoxy of the day and in doing so founded Protestantism in the early 16th century. Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormon movement in 1830. And Song Myung Moon, founder of the Unification Church, or Moonies as they're often known, in 1954. So, was Jesus like any of these characters? Well, if he deliberately misled his followers to justify his ambitions, there would be similarities with Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, and Hitler, who all used similar methods to further their political ambitions. However, Jesus' teachings and message are clearly completely at odds with the political ideas of these ideologues and monsters, and the murderous methods they employed to further these ambitions. To suggest a similarity between them and Jesus borders on the preposterous. If he deliberately misled his followers primarily so he could exert power over them, there would be some similarities with David Koresh, Jim Jones, and Charles Manson. Well, we can discount Charles Manson immediately. He was a petty criminal. He had some half-baked ideas about an apocalyptic end time that would be preceded by a sort of class war. Most of his ideas came from the words of a few songs out of the Beatles' White Album. He collected a small following, went on a killing spree, no real parallels with Jesus. However, there are a few parallels with Koresh and Jones. Charismatic figure, radical teachings, devoted followers, everyone dies proclaiming these beliefs, including the leader. However, a closer look at these messianic figures, in inverted commas, and this all begins to start falling apart. David Koresh, the man on the extreme left middle, or Vernon Wayne Howell, his original name, was a high school dropout. He allegedly had an affair with the prophetess of the Branch Davidian cult, then in her late 60s. He assumed leadership of the cult by armed means, advocated polygamy, and developed a harem in the cult compound, fathering around a dozen children as a result. All the other men in the compound had to be celibate. Former Branch Davidians accused Koresh of having sex with underage girls and physically abusing children. Koresh founded the sect by the buying and selling of firearms. The Waco siege was initiated by the US government, who were investigating allegations of illegal firearms and explosives in the cult compound. Jim Jones, the character in the middle, if you like, was a Christian teacher who set up his own church based on racially integrated communist utopian lines. He claimed to be an incarnation of Jesus, Akhenaten, Buddha, and Lenin. He was a drug abuser, LSD and marijuana. He was convicted of homosexual soliciting in 1973. People that left his movement made claims of brutal beatings, murders, and a mass suicide plan. Jones' armed guard killed five of a group from the US government that had come to investigate human rights abuses at the sect's compound in Guyana. Shortly afterwards, there was a mass murder at the compound, followed by the suicides of those who were likely to have carried out the killings. Jones was also found dead. I'm hard-pressed to find any real parallels with the Jesus that we find in the Gospels and these characters. However, judge for yourself. I pulled these potted biographies that I've just run through straight off Wikipedia. Read these for yourself. Read the Gospels for yourself. Do the comparisons yourself. And for the rest, from my researches, I can't find any evidence of Mahatma Gandhi, Fidel Castro, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther, or Sun Myung-moon, Joseph Smith, deliberately misleading their followers for their own ends. Now, you may or may not agree with these people's political or religious views. Indeed, some of the things that Joseph Smith hasn't really stood, in terms of the Book of Mormon, doesn't really stand up to historical scrutiny. Some of Martin Luther's views on Jewish people is pretty anti-Semitic. However, you know, you can pick your way through these things. However, these leaders that we know who deliberately mislead their followers also seem to be capable of a whole lot of other misdeeds as well, as we've just described. So, where does Jesus fit this picture? The list of reasons I gave earlier as to why someone might deliberately mislead their followers just doesn't seem to fit with a picture we have of Jesus in the Gospels. Also, had he been this type of person, I think we might have seen some evidence of this surviving outside the Gospels, particularly from those who were Jesus' enemies, that is, the Romans and the Jewish authorities. As you know, the easiest way of killing off a fledgling movement is to attack the personal feelings of its leader, real or made up. Now, there's certainly evidence of attack on Jesus' teachings and on the beliefs of Christians. For example, Tacitus and Pliny, who we discussed earlier, were particularly dismissive of Christians and Christianity. However, we have no detailed personal attacks on Jesus himself. This, I think, is significant. So, it looks like he thought he was the Son of God. It looks like he wasn't mad or delusional. And it's very unlikely that he knowingly or unknowingly misled his disciples to believe he was the Son of God. So, what are we left with? Well, maybe, just maybe, he was who he said he was. Now, at this point, I'm not sure what you're thinking. It's possible that you'll be thinking what I was thinking when I got to this point when I first read The Case for Christ, the book I talked about in the first evening. Perhaps you're thinking that what you've heard so far sounds pretty plausible, but perhaps, like I was thinking, well, this all happened a very long time ago. I'm certainly not sure. I'm certainly not convinced. Well, if what we've been looking at over the last 2 weeks was all the evidence for Jesus being the Son of God, I'd still think this. However, next week, what we'll be doing is looking at the one event on which the existence of Christianity stands or falls, that is, the death and resurrection of Jesus. Is there compelling evidence to support this being an actual historical event? Thanks very much.